But me no see no girl. When me a go cut no man throat far. Police now put me in a bunker. Too much girl in a bunker. Girl from Tivoli, Nanny Pills outside Rima. Girl from Jungle, Chinese a production. So we go up over girl, we no fight over girl. Real general now war over girl. Over girl, we no fight over girl. Now must no SLR over no girl. Over girl, we no fight over girl. Now go a penitentiary over girl. Over girl, we no war over girl. Real general now war. When we touch the road, look how the girls them enough now. Good girl, they are road, we got the right stuff. Right type we tight, one them we buff. Can't believe say John John shoot down Rufus. Over precious way always a please us. Now him gone a prison for 10 more Christmas. Everywhere we go, everywhere we touch, everywhere we pass. Now we the girls them a rust. Over girl, we no fight over girl. Now go my penitentiary over no girl. Over girl, we no war over girl. Now must no SLR over no girl. When we touch the road, when we touch the road, when we touch the road. Tell them we no fear, don't be close. When we touch the road, when we
touch the road. There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the January 2011 edition of No One's Legal Radio. We're part of CKUT Community News Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're also rebroadcast on Operation Wake Up on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax and podcast on rabble.ca. News for the rest of us. 90.3 FM in Montreal, 88.1 FM in Halifax. You can find No One's Legal Radio on the left side of your radio dial. This month's show focuses on the upcoming Whose Security, Our Security, Countering the National Security Agenda Forum. That's going to be taking place from February 4th to the 6th at Concordia University in Montreal. It's a forum that builds on the 2006 People's Commission that created the People's Commission Network. It's holding a conference to mobilize networks to collectively address the growing threat of the national security state. Some of the themes will be historical perspectives on national security, military security industrial complex, CSIS Watch, blacklists and blacklisting, and immigration security measures. So on today's show, we'll be hearing from three people who will be participating on that forum. We'll be getting some context to some of these themes and some background to the upcoming forum on national security and how to counter the national security agenda. This month's show is hosted and produced by members of No One's Legal in Montreal in collaboration with the CKUT Community News Collective. No One's Legal Montreal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance fighting for justice and dignity and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to No One's Legal Radio. a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination of migrants, refugees, indigenous people. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. We're also podcasts on rabble.ca, and we're rebroadcast on Operation Wake Up on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax. 90.3 FM in Montreal, 88.1 FM in Halifax. You can find No One's Legal Radio on the left side of radio dial. Today's show, our January 2011 edition, is focusing on the upcoming forum. It's called Whose Security, Our Security, Countering the National Security Agenda. It's a forum organized by the People's Commission Network here in Montreal, focusing on the national security state, bringing together activists, speakers, people on the front lines who have dealt with countering the national security agenda, particularly in the aftermath of 9/11, building on efforts by support committees all over the country, but particularly on issues around security certificates, blacklists and blacklisting, etc. For all the information about the upcoming forum, you should check out the website. It's www.peoplescommission.org. That's www.peoplescommission.org with all the details of where, when, and who's speaking. On today's show, we're going to highlight some of the themes, some of the content of the upcoming forum. We have three speakers lined up that I spoke with earlier today. Our first speaker is someone who's been at the heart of both strategizing and organizing against the national security agenda. She's a local community organizer and activist who's done tremendous organizing and work with a lot of passion, a lot of intelligence. Her name is Mary Foster, and I talked to her earlier today about the upcoming forum against police brutality. The forum countering the national security agenda. Again, for details, check out www.peoplescommission.org. But we'll go to that interview with Mary Foster right now. I'm speaking with Mary Foster. Mary is a community organizer and activist based in Montreal. She is active with the People's Commission Network here in Montreal, and she's one of the key organizers of the upcoming Whose Security, Our Security, Countering the National Security Agenda Conference, which will be happening here in Montreal between February 4th to 6th. Mary, welcome again to No One's Legal Radio.
Thank you.
Mary, we come to this this conference this coming February after basically a decade or so of organizing against the national security agenda. The first People's Commission, the original People's Commission here in Montreal, took place in April of 2006, and that was sort of the culmination of several years of organizing in the aftermath of 9/11, dealing with people directly affected by security certificates, dealing with communities who were being targeted by racial profiling and social profiling. Before we go on to talk about the upcoming forum, could you describe that original People's Commission that gave rise to the People's Commission Network? What were the concerns? What was the context that brought that together? Bring us back to that period in 2005, 2006 that led to the People's Commission here in Montreal.
Well, after 2001, I think there was a lot of focus among activists on international solidarity, so concerns around Iraq and Afghanistan and the invasions and Canada's role in the occupations of those countries. And then I think there was an increasing shift with the influence of No One Is Illegal and then the formation of Solidarity Across Borders in 2003, 2004. And people started, I think, increasingly looking at how the so-called war on terror was being applied here in Montreal in Canada. And in 2003, when Adil Sharkawi was arrested under a security certificate in Montreal, I think it really was a flashpoint which made people realize the extent of the harassment and the extent of the state repression in the name of, you know, the war on terror and national security here in Montreal. So in building that campaign around Sharkawi's struggle against security certificates, the support group that was working with him came up with the idea of holding a people's forum, people's commission that would look into the impact of these measures more broadly on our communities here in Montreal and time it at the same time that Sharkawi's challenge to the security certificate process was going to the Supreme Court. So it was a people's a popular initiative to look at these things among ourselves, as opposed to having experts and people discussing it in these really rarefied courtrooms in their own terms. So the first People's Commission Network, it was 3 days of hearings, and we heard some people testifying about their experiences with state harassment, specifically people who were in immigration processes, so were extremely vulnerable to deportation or to being detained or to remaining in limbo for years and years.
Could you talk a bit more specifically about some of those some of the specific cases that were revealed at the People's Commission, or at least shared at the People's Commission? Because one of the key roles it played was to break a lot of fear and isolation that people were feeling about these issues. A lot of people were suffering through these immigration security measures, but felt like they were alone. And what the People's Commission did was say, "Well, you're not alone." Could you share with our listeners some of those cases that came up?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, it was extremely moving and empowering for people to be standing up together and actually speaking about these things aloud. So there was, there were a wide range of cases. There were the security certificate cases. So Adil Sharkawi was there and testified. He was already, you know, out in the public. But other people who were less in the public, family members of security certificate detainees, including the son of Mr. Jabala in Toronto, gave a really moving account of what he and his family had suffered for years and years as family members of the people who detained under security certificates. There were several people who talked about harassment in that sort of gray area, which is kind of an informal harassment that doesn't, you know, it's not legislated in the way a security certificate is, but is no less has a huge impact on people's lives. And so people talked about how they'd been interviewed at certain points by CSIS or by the ICMP and then come under suspicion and then had just been sitting in a state of limbo for years. Other people talked about being detained, coming here as refugees, and instead of being received as a refugee and finding a place of sanction, that instead ended up in detention. So there was a number of really powerful stories that were shared and then analyzed together.
For our listeners, I encourage them to check out peoplescommission.org, where an awful lot of the testimonies, the popular education work as a direct result of the People's Commission is shared and continues to be updated. Mary, that original People's Commission against so-called immigration security measures took place in April of 2006. The upcoming forum on countering the national security agenda, which is very much in the, you know, a follow-up on the People's Commission, is taking place this February, almost 5 years after that original commission. It's a difficult question, I know, but can you assess these last 5 years of organizing, as you described and as I framed it? The People's Commission in 2006 was very much a response to organizing and dynamics in the aftermath of 9/11 and local organizing in Montreal around the 2002 to 2004 period, with, as you said, the arrest of Adil Sharkawi acting as a catalyst locally to get people engaged and organized on these issues. But how do you assess and how do you look at the last 5 years? What's your assessment of that, bringing us, you know, 5 years after the, almost 5 years after the commission?
Well, I mean, there's been sort of obvious things that have happened. Several of the security certificate cases have been won. Some of them haven't and are still in the midst of fighting. So it's sort of a draw on that campaign. And the sort of space that was opened up, I think, by the People's Commission Network here in Montreal around these issues, we've moved into that more. And I think are able to talk about some of these issues and the level of CSIS harassment is something that is being more and more openly discussed and confronted, at least in certain communities. I think secrecy and fear still reigns in other situations. So there's certainly a lot of work to be done on that front. I think some of the relationships that were established through organizing the first People's Commission hearings in 2006 have been developed and built on, and those are, I think, really the most important thing that came out of 2006, and that we're now going into 2011 on quite a different level, and able to build on the trust that we've established over those years among those of the various groups and communities that are being targeted by national security measures.
Mary, when we look at the issues that surround this whole, you know, that fall within the umbrella of the theme national security, you know, if I look at it anecdotally or impressionistically, it's a bit overwhelming. You know, we can mention names like Meher Arar, Omar Khadr, rendition, torture, people who are on blacklists. And as you know, and as I know, as people who work with people day to day, there's a lot of names that we don't hear about, but just communities, individuals, families that are targeted. It's just somewhat overwhelming, it seems, at times to sort of get a grip on what we mean by national security, what we mean by countering the national security agenda. And I know, as a way of approaching this issue, the organizers of the upcoming forum, Whose Security, Our Security, have sort of broken down what at times is an overwhelming array of issues and individuals and incidents and dynamics, and broken that down into categories and themes so that we can explore them and come up with action plans at the forum. So can you describe what those themes are and how they've come together, what motivates the breakdown of the forum as a way for us to sort of more concretely organize against the national security agenda?
I think what we did was basically we did a couple of consultations with people we've been working with, both informally and formally in a consulta, as we started organizing this conference. And I think the idea was to build on work that we've already done in campaigns that were already started, but at the same time to have a look overall and see what in our work was missing, where the gaps were that we maybe needed to start pushing in a more coherent or consistent way. So something that's actually quite new that we haven't done before is one of the working groups, and that's the working group on the security industrial complex, which is looking at the industry here in Montreal, which is producing the technologies and the equipment that allows this, that facilitates state repression, so it's surveillance equipment or crowd control equipment, and ways of controlling and watching communities and social movements. So that is something new, and that's going to be one of the themes that's addressed at the conference, where there'll be an overview given of that industry here in Montreal, and then a working workshop will look at how to take that work forward, maybe through popular education in the short term, and then looking ahead to see what should be done in the long term around that. So that's one new aspect that we put together that we're looking at in the conference. Another theme is building really on this the work of the 2006, so we're calling it immigration, so-called security measures. So people who are in the vulnerable situation of being in immigration processes and then are labeled in some way, or their communities are labeled in some way. So we'll look at a range. Here what we wanted to do was look back at the campaigns that we've organized and take stock of how we did that and analyze where we could could go with these and how we could do our work better around the security certificate campaigns and other aspects of immigration security measures. So looking at we've asked people from three different campaigns or organizations to give an analysis of how those campaigns went and how they could be done better. So Hassan Omri will be here from Toronto, and he'll be looking at the security certificate campaign as he experienced it, and you know how that campaign was successful and where it wasn't successful, and how he thinks he'll be giving his analysis of that. Then someone will be talking about, Nazila Bittash will be talking about the campaign around Ivan Apolozo Sancho, who was arrested and then deported to Spain under a terrorist label again. And that campaign had its own unique dynamics, and so she'll be providing analysis on that. And finally, we've asked Mustafa Hanawi from the Immigrant Workers Center to talk about people who are living in security limbo, so that have been called in for some kind of security industry and then just never hear back on their immigration files for 5, 10, sometimes it's up to 15, the longest I've heard is 25 years. Typically that whole issue is people are completely silent on it. There's very little organizing work that's been doing public organizing around it. So Mustafa will be looking at that, evaluating the kind of support work that IWC has been doing around that, and then where we need to go on that issue as well. So that's another whole theme that will be brought to the fore. And in the workshop for the immigration security measures theme, we've decided to focus really on media campaigns. So that's a lot of where this battle is being fought. So people will be looking at some of the media campaigns around, for example, around the arrival of the Tamil refugees this summer in Vancouver, and how they were quickly labeled as threats and terrorists, and how the response was from people who were working in support of the Tamils who are coming. So we'll be looking at some of those case studies, and then seeing again how we can create a stronger either response or do some proactive work around these issues in the media, in the mainstream media, as well as in our own alternative and community-based media.
CKUT presents Prison Radio, a monthly series concerning Canada's prisoners.
Issues will include women in prison, prisoners' health, religion in prison, prison labor, and life sentences and parole.
Prison Radio, the second Thursday of every month on Off the Hour.
Hear news and views about one of Canada's most marginalized communities, its prisoners.
The last decade was marked by a threat towards expanding government and police powers of surveillance, arrest and control in the name of national security and the war against terror. Toute forme d'opposition, de dissidence et de résistance est criminalisée. Dans ce contexte, organisons la riposte à la dérive sécuritaire. The People's Commission Network is holding a free popular forum to collectively address the growing threat of the national security agenda. Joignez-vous à nous les 4, 5 et 6 février 2011 à l'Université Concordia. Free food and childcare will be provided. The Who's Security, Our Security Forum is a CKUT co-presentation. Pour l'horaire complet et les détails, www.commissionpopulaire.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to No One's Legal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. We're also podcasts on rabble.ca, and we're rebroadcast on Operation Wake Up on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax. You can find No One's Legal Radio on the left side of your radio dial. Today's show is focusing on the upcoming conference, Who's Security, Our Security, countering the national security agenda. This conference is taking place between February 4th to 6th. You should check out the website, www.peoplescommission.org. That's www.peoplescommission.org. We heard earlier an excerpt of a longer interview with Mary Foster, one of the organizers of that upcoming forum. I also wanted to highlight some events that are taking place prior to the forum, building towards that forum that addresses the issue of some of the issues that will be addressed at the forum in general. This coming Tuesday, there's going to be a film screening at CUPER Concordia, not at CUPER Concordia, at Concordia University, but organized by CUPER Concordia in collaboration with the forum, the forum that's going to be taking place. That's next Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. It's going to be a screening of Les Ordres, The Orders, which is an NFB classic film from 1974 about the October Crisis and the War Measures Act. It's been described as one of the best Canadian films ever made. So that's this coming Tuesday at the H110 Auditorium on Concordia University campus, presented by CUPER Concordia in collaboration with the People's Commission Network. As well, there's going to be a walking tour this coming Sunday, not this Sunday, on Sunday, January 16th, 2 p.m. at Carré Barry. It's described as a troupement illégal, and it's basically a walking tour of some of the sites of mass arrests by the Montreal police in the past 15 years or so. As well, there's going to be a benefit show, Beats Against the Security Agenda. That's January 27th at 8 p.m. at Il Motore. It's a lot of info there, the upcoming forum, the film taking place next Tuesday, a walking tour on January 16th, a benefit show. So to get all that info, I just, again, encourage folks to check out the website of the People's Commission. That's peoplescommission.org. We have two more interviews to play on the show, previewing the upcoming Who Security, Our Security, Countering the National Security Agenda Forum that's taking place February 4th to 6th. The next interview is with Gary Kinsman. Gary will be present at the forum in February. He is a sociologist up at Laurentian University in Sudbury, and he's written the book, or co-authored the book, The Canadian War on Queers. National Security as Sexual Regulation. So we'll go to that interview with Gary Kinsman right now. I'm speaking with Gary Kinsman. Gary is a professor of sociology at Laurentian University. He is the author, co-author of The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation, and he's also the editor of Who's National Security? Gary will be one of the featured speakers at the upcoming conference, Who's Security, Our Security, organized by the People's Commission Network. Gary, welcome to No One's Legal Radio.
Welcome to talk to you, Jaggy. It's really great.
Could you summarize for us the thesis of your book about the Canadian War on Queers? I guess the title is sort of self-explanatory, but draw out for us some of the key themes that you explored, and I would say explored uniquely. This is sort of the first time, I think, this has come out publicly. Tell us, tell our listeners a little bit about your book.
Well, the book is co-written with Patrizia Gentile, and it's basically the first major documentation of the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men, running from basically the late 1950s in Canada through to the early 1990s, although in some ways that campaign against queers still continues. It documents, you know, how thousands of people were purged from their jobs, how people were put under surveillance, how the Canadian government tried to develop this detection technology that the RCMP called the fruit machine. It documents, you know, quite horrific forms of abuse and denial of human rights, basic rights for people identified as lesbians and gay men, but it also documents a sort of wonderful story of resistance and subversion directed against the national security campaigns. So it's the first major book in Canada to do this. And one of the reasons why we wanted to do it was not simply to record and document what happened in the historical past, although that's very important, and we still think it's crucial that this is recognized, that the Canadian government apologize for this, that people whose careers were destroyed get compensated for the damage that was done to their lives, both within the military and within the public service. But we also wanted to look at this to see what it allows us to bring into view around the current national security campaigns, whether it's against anti-capitalist protesters or whether it's under the cover of the so-called War on Terror, where People who are identified as Muslim and Arab are basically undergoing the same types of national security campaigns, being denied their rights. One of the things that's really clear to us from our historical investigation is that national security is always and everywhere an ideological practice. It operates to include some people within the fabric of the nation and to expel other people from the fabric of the nation. In the context of the Canadian War on Queers, basically what it did was construct lesbians and gay men per se, because we supposedly suffered from a character weakness that made us supposedly vulnerable to blackmail from evil Soviet agents, even though I should point out there's absolutely no evidence of this ever happening in the Canadian context. And the people we talked to said the only people who ever tried to blackmail them were the RCMP, who tried to get them to give the names of their friends and other lesbians and gay men. So they basically expel lesbians and gay men from the fabric of the nation from the late 50s on. They basically constructed the nation as having a heterosexual character. Heterosexuality was associated with safety, with being Canadian, with the nation, with national security. Well, lesbians and gay men from the late 50s, in uneven ways through to the 1990s, were constructed as risks to national security. We were expelled from the fabric of the nation. What we see going on right now is that under the cover of the so-called War on Terror, what we have happening is people who are identified as being Muslim or Arab are basically being expelled from the fabric of the Canadian nation. They're defined as threats, as risks. They're denied their basic human rights, their basic civil rights, and they're basically expelled from the fabric of the nation. We want to point out, and one of the things we discover in the research for the book, is that national security always has two sides to it. One is it identifies an enemy, an other, that is expelled from the fabric of the nation. But the other side of that is that it also constructs at the center of the nation a particular group of people. In the context of the Canadian War on Queers, it was constructing heterosexuality as the supposedly national, safe, normal, and natural sexuality in the Canadian context. In the context of the so-called War on Terror, it is operating to construct sort of a white, Christian-derived sort of culture at the center of Canada and expelling from the notion of Canada people who are identified as being Arab or Muslim.
Gary, I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners more about how you were able to uncover this this war on queers. What kind of research did you do? How were you able to obtain this information to essentially expose the construction of basically lesbians and gay men as national security risks?
Well, our first and most important source of information was talking to people who were directly affected. So we talked to more than 50 people in terms of the writing of the book, people who were directly affected by the national security campaigns in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We talked to them in great detail about what had happened to them, and we learned an awful lot from them, not only about how the national security police and the national security campaigns operated, but also about their strategies of resistance, their strategies of negotiation of these national security campaigns. So that was our first and most important source of information, learning from people directly about their experiences. In many ways, our book and our research is a sort of history and a sociology from below, starting from the standpoints of the people who were most directly affected by the national security campaigns. But we also were able to access state documents, RCMP documents, through the Access to Information Program. This was actually started in 1992 by Dean Beebe, a really good investigative journalist who was working with Canadian Press and still is, who uncovered some of the first documents, and we proceeded to make more access requests. Now, we didn't get all the information we wanted. They blank out all sorts of crucial information that you want to look at and read, but nonetheless, it did provide us with a sense of how they organized the national security campaigns from above. So by bringing these two sources of knowledge together, we were able to develop a quite comprehensive analysis. But again, the most important defining source of information and knowledge was the people who were most directly affected by these national security campaigns.
Gary, you've mentioned that issues remain unresolved around this war on queers that dates from at least the 50s until the 80s. What are those unresolved issues, and what are the campaigns, what's the organizing that's being done to make sure that those issues get resolved?
Well, there needs to be a lot more organizing done than is happening right now. I think, unfortunately, the mainstream of the gay and lesbian movements have actually become quite complacent around these questions of national security. But even recently, this fall, there has been some media coverage, especially through Radio Canada and CBC, about the experiences of those people who were purged from the military, especially the lesbians who were purged from the military. Darl Wood, for instance, who now lives in Truro, Nova Scotia, was purged from the military in the late 1970s in Nova Scotia, and she, and along with many other people, are still wanting an apology for what took place to them that basically destroyed their careers and lives in many ways, but also are arguing in many ways for compensation. And this has happened in other jurisdictions. So, for instance, in England, because of a decision made by the human rights courts in Europe, people are actually able to get compensation for the wrong that was done to them in terms of them being purged from the military. What we have in the Canadian context is a government that has never really officially apologized for these national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men, and there's no policy put in place for compensation for people whose careers were destroyed. There is an attempt to launch a class action suit, again coming out of Nova Scotia, with a lawyer from Halifax trying to launch a class action suit for those people who were purged from the military basically around the time that the Charter was implemented, to argue that because the Charter wasn't actually implemented, the equality rights section of the Charter wasn't implemented for these people, that they actually should get compensation for the wrong that was done to them. So there are various things that are happening, but we need a lot more of this to be going on.
Gary, you've spoken about how groups of people, in this case lesbians and gay men, are constructed as national security risks. And you've spoken about how national security isn't some objective thing. It's something that's ideological. Speak about the ideology that motivated the construction of gays and lesbians in Canada as national security risks. Break that down for us.
Well, I mean, what you really have to see is that there was a construction of the notion of the nation as being heterosexual in character. And it was actually quite central to the project of constructing Canadian society and the Canadian state as being heterosexual and heterosexist to define lesbians and gay men and bisexuals and trans people and anyone who expressed sort of gender and sexual diversity beyond the sort of heterosexual norm, to define those people as being abnormal, other, deviant, sick, criminal, or as risks to national security. So it's in that broader context of the construction of the marginalization and oppression of queer people that the national security campaigns take place. So they don't take place on their own. There is a much broader social and political generation of campaigns against lesbians and gay men during this period of time. But the other side of that, the other side of the campaigns against lesbians and gay men, is the construction of what we describe as heterosexual hegemony in the Canadian context. Now, it's important to point out that this has earlier roots. There's purges against people who were identified as homosexual and lesbians from the military during World War II. There are major campaigns in the 1950s that lead to a heightened criminalization of male homosexual practices in particular. So there's a broader social context to this. There's also the influence coming from the United States, which identifies queer people as a risk to national security at a much earlier moment than it happens in Canada, but there's a major influence of the U.S. national security state on the Canadian context as well. But basically what you see happening with national security is how the nation gets constructed in particular types of ways that include some people and exclude lots of other people. And of course this has happened in relationship to all sorts of other groups. It happened in relationship to people on the left, in the Communist Party, people in the trade union movement, people in various immigrant and ethnic communities. In the 1960s, you know, basically high school students organizing in their schools were identified as national security risks. The feminist movement, when it began to organize in the late 1960s, early 1970s, was identified as a risk to national security. We're all aware of how the sovereignty movement in Quebec was constructed as a risk to national security and the various dirty tricks that the RCMP engaged in against the sovereignty organizations in Quebec. So there were a lot of different groups that were targeted as being other, different, as enemies to the state, and national security practices were mobilized against them. If they're successful in defining a group of people as being national security risks, they then can cut those people out of the regular types of human and civil rights that people would expect to have in the Canadian context.
Gary, you'll be coming to Montreal in February to participate in the conference, Who Security, Our Security, Countering the National Security Agenda, and you're scheduled to speak on a panel about the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service. It's being framed as who needs them. CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, is what the RCMP security service that you explore in your book used to be. There's a continuity there. How would you answer that question that's being framed in this panel, just to give us a bit of a preview of your remarks about whether we need CSIS, whether we need these national security institutions?
Well, if you actually look at where CSIS comes from, I think this answers part of the question. Basically, I was just pointing out how the RCMP had major national security campaigns against lots of groups of people, including the left and the sovereignty or independence movement in Quebec. When that became very public and visible, when people started to organize in the 1970s against these various violations of people's democratic rights, and this was particularly intense in Quebec, but it also happened across the Canadian state, there was, of course, a legitimation crisis produced for the Canadian state. The RCMP was seen as having done improper, unethical, and perhaps even illegal activity in numerous situations, including the barn burning situation in Quebec, a whole bunch of other situations, stealing the membership lists of various organizations. All of this was seen and became organized around and became a real crisis for the Canadian state. What is it going to do? Well, it sets up a commission that studies these questions, the McDonald Commission, and its recommendation is actually that we should separate national security work from the RCMP. The RCMP was sort of not properly trained to do this, according to them, and they needed a sort of new specialized force that was focused on national security questions. Now, the Canadian government actually didn't fully implement what the McDonald Commission suggested, but what they did propose was a new security service called CSIS. Now, CSIS basically does the same types of things that the RCMP used to do. Most of the personnel who were hired within CSIS were RCMP officers who'd previously done this national security work. There was no major transformation in what the security police force was. And basically, CSIS has continued to engage in all of the same types of practices that the RCMP had engaged in. It engages in practices that deny people their rights. It engages in activities that many of us on the left and in terms of grassroots social movements would consider to be illegal and violations of the charter. It continues to engage in those and to get away with many of those because it argues it's able to do this because these are questions and matters of national security, which provides some level of protection for CSIS if they're able to successfully claim that. Well, what I would want to suggest is we don't need a police force, national security police force, that systematically violates and denies people's rights. What we actually need to think about is the security of working class people, people of color, lesbians and gay men, women, various groups of people across the country. That's whose security is important. National security and police forces like CSIS operate simply to defend those who have power in our society, powerful state interests, and operate to deny the rights of various groups of people. So I would actually support the abolition of CSIS. And what we need to talk about instead is a very, very different form of security that's not security from above, but instead security from below in terms of how we can provide protection and rights for people in our communities, people who experience oppression and exploitation. Obviously, that's tied up with a broader project of social transformation and social justice as well.
Gary Kinsman, thank you so much for speaking with us on Noise Legal Radio, and we're looking forward to your presentation at the upcoming Who Security, Our Security conference here in Montreal. Thanks, Gary.
I'm quite looking forward to the conference myself, and it's great to talk with you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Noise Legal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. Our show today is focused on immigration or security measures in general in anticipation of the upcoming forum that's entitled Whose Security? Question mark. Our Security! Exclamation mark. Countering the National Security Agenda. And we're going to go to the last interview previewing that upcoming conference. And it's somebody who has been at the front lines of supporting and dealing with this National Security Agenda. I'm going to be going to an interview right now with Sophie Harkat. She's the partner of Mohammed Harkat, who's been under a security certificate since December 10th, 2002. This is an archetypical case, one of those cases that will be explored at the upcoming forum. So I'll go to that interview with Sophie Harkat right now. I'm speaking with Sophie Harkat. Sophie is the partner of Mohammed Harkat. Mohammed Harkat is currently under security certificate. He's been under that security certificate since December 10th, 2002. I'm speaking to Sophie from who's in Ottawa. Sophie, welcome again to No One's Legal Radio.
Thank you.
It's great to speak to you. I'd like to speak to Mohammed as well, although he is still under the security certificate, which means he's under some of the strictest bail conditions that we've seen in Canadian history, one of which is that he can't speak to anyone with a criminal record, and I'm the co-host with the criminal record, so unfortunately I can't speak to him. Maybe you can just outline for listeners the conditions that your partner, Mohammed, has to continue to live under this as a result of being under a security certificate.
Well, compared to about a year and a half ago, our conditions are quite light. Right now he has to wear a GPS 24 hours a day. We cannot leave Ottawa area or Gatineau area without notice to CBSA at least 48 hours in advance, and they have to approve the trip. So going to Montreal would be another hurdle for us because we have to get the trip approved. He cannot access the basement where we have a computer or access directly or indirectly a computer or internet as well as cell phones. He has a lot of money on his head, and he still has sureties, and he's not allowed to travel outside of town alone. He doesn't have a passport. He's still got quite a bit of conditions, but last year we used to have surveillance cameras in the house. The phone was tapped. The mail was intercepted. We were followed by CBSA immigration officers when we went out wearing bulletproof vests and guns. We can only go out three times a week for 4 hours. Every individual that he was in contact with had to be pre-approved by the Canadian Border Service Agency. And so we had the toughest bail package in Canadian history. Now, compared to what we had a year ago, we're still struggling, but the conditions are much lighter.
There's been a whole trajectory to this struggle that you and Mohammed have gone through. You've described these strict house arrest conditions, but of course, Mohammed also spent time in prison. He was under solitary confinement for about a year. So can you just give a bit of background to the case of Mohammed?
So he was arrested on December 10, 2002, which ironically happens to be International Human Rights Day. He was thrown in jail without charge or access to the evidence. That's the thing about the security certificate, is that you're kept in the dark. You don't know the evidence against you because it is kept secret for national security reasons. So he spent 43 months at the Ottawa Carlton Detention Center and was transferred for a short period of time at the Guantanamo Prison in the Kingston area, which is a facility that was built specifically to house presumed terrorists or security certificate detainees. He got bail later after that in June of 2006. And for 3.5 years, basically some of the toughest conditions in Canadian history, which I listed before, and I was one of the main sureties, so that means I had to stay with him 24 hours a day, either outside the house or inside the house. Even in the backyard, he could never be left alone, or inside the house, he could never be left alone. It was just myself, my mother, and another surety that could do that role. And so for 3.5 years, I was my husband's jailer. I was a prisoner in my own home. We were living through tremendous stress. We were dehumanized, degraded. The government really basically dehumanized in every way possible for the past 8 years. Now, the conditions are lighter, but we are still struggling with the fact that we lost a security certificate just recently, so there is more struggle ahead of us. So this battle for us has lasted 8 years. We won a Supreme Court challenge back in February 2007, which found the certificate to be unconstitutional, and then the government created a new law, which is cosmetic changes by adding a special advocate, which can see the secret evidence, but cannot speak to my husband and to the public counsel. So the secrecy remains. And so we've been fighting very hard to abolish the security certificate process, and make sure that these men detained under security certificates have the right to a fair and open trial.
Sophie, you were present at the People's Commission on Immigration Security Measures here in Montreal back in 2006. It's almost 5 years later. Could you assess the last 5 years of struggle? You've given an overview of that struggle since 2002, but in particular, the last 5 years, clearly there have been changes since 2006. As you've just mentioned, the security certificate law has been declared unconstitutional. There have been the introduction of special advocates. Many of the men who were under security certificates have had theirs quashed. Unfortunately, Mohammed's isn't quashed yet. It's been upheld, but hopefully that will change soon. So can you assess the last half decade or so of mobilizing around this case? The case of your partner Mohammed is sort of a prototypical example of what immigration security measures are all about, something that's going to be explored at the forum later in February.
Well, when I testified a few years ago, I testified mostly about my own experiences about visiting my husband in jail, because at the time my husband was in jail. What the campaign has done, not only my campaign, but with the efforts of Montreal and Toronto and across the country, the supporters, we've managed to get all five guys out of jail, which was a big accomplishment. So at one point, all five detainees on the security certificate were released under bail conditions, but some of the toughest bail conditions in Canadian history. Later, we won a Supreme Court challenge that found the certificate to be unconstitutional in February of 2007. Then in 2008, they reissued a security certificate to all the detainees, which some of us took to court. And the Jabal and Majoub are proceedings in court right now. And two certificates were quashed since, and my husband was upheld on December the 9th, which is the day before International Human Rights Day and the day of his anniversary. And so for the past, for the first 3.5 years after that, Mo was under the toughest bail conditions, and now he has lighter bail conditions, but we are still struggling. We lost a security certificate a couple of weeks ago. We are devastated. We never expected this, you know, this turn of events, because we had the strongest case out of the five in sense that they use evidence coming from torture. The informant failed a lie detector test. We cannot find the original CSIS agent who actually worked on Mo's file. They destroyed every single piece of original material. So there's no original material whatsoever, no interviews, no transcripts, no intercepts. There's nothing original from the case. And so there's been many, many mistakes on the CSIS side, but it wasn't enough to win the certificate, which was upheld on December the 9th.
Yeah, and just to underline this for our listeners, essentially, Mohammed doesn't even have the right to a trial. If they feel like he's done anything wrong, like anyone else, he should be put on trial and be able to see the evidence against him and challenge that evidence and be able to make a defense. And he has none of those. He can take advantage of none of those things in this situation. It's insidious.
Correct. If you look at the Canadian law, I mean, if you, for example, would destroy one piece of evidence, in most cases, the case would fall apart. In my husband's case, it's based on secret evidence. And now we know that they're using information, for example, coming from an informant, which credibility was never put into question in public and was never put into question in secret, because we know these special advocates only had access to his files, not to the informant himself, because one of the most, you know, person that's mostly has the most secure position in there, because his name is never going to be revealed. So that's just one of many examples. And if you look at the criminal law, you have access to the evidence, so you can defend yourself, so you can test the credibility of the informants, of the information. But when you don't have any original material, you don't have access to informants, you don't have access to the evidence for national security reasons, there's basically no public case. So we're just somewhat going on the allegation report, which is at some times like assumptions of what might be going wrong in the back and stuff like that. It's very difficult to explain in terms of somebody who's never been through a trial. But you know, anybody with common sense would understand that if they were in my husband's shoes, they would want to defend themselves openly and fairly with the evidence, which doesn't happen in a security certificate case. That's why we're fighting for due process. That's the main reason why I'm fighting so hard, is because we believe in the process. We want a fair process.
What I find particularly insidious about this is that the fact that Mohammed has lived a normal life during his time in Canada is being held against him. In other words, if he associates with certain people that he shouldn't associate with, that's suspicious. If he doesn't, that's also suspicious. It's just there's nothing that he can do that would not be seen as being suspicious. It's clear profiling, and in this case, it's racist profiling.
Well, correct. After 9/11, the men detained under security certificate all happened to be Muslims, Arab men. And in my husband's case, he arrived in Canada in 1995, and they granted him refugee status in 1997. And if you look at the allegations, they're not allegations that are now. They're allegations that date back from the early 90s, basically. And how do you defend yourself when it's like 20, 25 years ago? I mean, you don't remember every detail of your life. And like I said, we have to keep reminding people that it's based on secret evidence. That's the unfair process. I mean, nobody remembers exactly who they talked to 20 years ago or what they did 20 years ago. I mean, my husband's story has never changed from day one. He's had the same exact story since the beginning. And, you know, one thing that they keep, for example, referring to him is that the fact that he used a fake passport. My husband is the, according to CSIS and according to their experts, is the only sleeper agent, because they called him a sleeper agent, that declared his fake passport when he entered Canada. He declared his Algerian passport and he declared his fake passport. But the media doesn't report it that way. You know, people are outraged that he used a fake passport, but that's what refugees do. And according to CSIS, their experts, he was the only one that ever told the truth when he came to Canada. So from the beginning, he told the truth. He said, this is my fake passport. This is my real passport. I can't use my real passport to enter Canada, you know, and these are the reasons why.
Sophie, you'll... We're going to have to end that interview with Sophie Harkat early. That wraps up the January 2011 edition of No One's Legal Radio. No One's Legal Radio is part of the CKUT Community News Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're also rebroadcast on Operation Wake Up on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax. You can also find our show podcast through www.rabble.ca/podcast. Thanks to everyone who contributed to today's broadcast, a special on the upcoming conference, Whose Security, Our Security, Countering the National Security Agenda. If you want all the details, go to the website www.peoplescommission.org. You can also go to www.commissionpopulaire.org. No One's Legal Montreal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance fighting for justice, dignity, and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. Our campaign is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, denouncing and taking action to combat racial profiling, police brutality, detentions, and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island. Shout out to my co-host, who's still in Winnipeg, Robin Maynard, and we'll be back on the air on the first Thursday of February. Stay tuned for Upstage.
Effective.